This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
Alrighty then, welcome everybody to another episode of Cinematica Animalia, the podcast where we look at somebody's favourite movie monster, creature, sci-fi horror, and see how it might work in real life by looking at their physiology and ecology. Today we are looking at the ecology of Modor, the forest god, or the bastard child of Loki from 2017's horror film The Ritual. We did the physiology last week. That was a real fun romp for our mate Dave. So go and check that out if you'd like to catch up. But in the meantime, my name is Sam Perrin. I'm a PhD candidate at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology. With me is a fellow PhD, Adam Chisak. Adam Chisak. Huh. PhD student from the
University of further away. We're not even in the H's anymore.
No, there's only so many ways you can mispronounce someone's name.
You'd be surprised.
Adam is a fellow PhD at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville. And we write and run ecologyforthemasses.com. And with us today is our vet friend Dave from Canada, podcast co-host number two. Oh. Okay, right. What do we... Oh, no, I remember what we wanted to start off by talking about today. The insect apocalypse.
Yes.
So this came about, and there was a similar study last year where something came out claiming we'd killed 60% of the 60% of the world's biodiversity in 45 years.
Something like that.
That study wasn't too bad. It was just that the press release... or the journalists... somehow took it out of context. But this, the insect apocalypse, if you've seen articles about this in your Facebook feed or whatever, was a hugely publicized report, which was talking about the downfall of insect communities and how insect biodiversity is just crashing worldwide. Now, the actual study itself had some serious biases, and it's been really hotly contested. But what I want to hear you guys' opinion of is, like, if something comes out like this, where we can kind of exaggerate a little bit, what do you think the response of the scientific community should be once that has come out? Because in from what I've seen, there's been a lot of vitriol saying this is horrible, this is stupid. We're misleading the public. Other people have just been like, hey, this is poor science. But I don't know, like, does that damage the public's opinion of us if we come out and just like we're seen as a big group of infighting dickheads?
I think in the short term, it's beneficial in the sense that it got a lot of media attention and a lot of people are now talking about it, but it is not sustainable and it is not a good idea in the long term because A, it's going to make people distrust scientists when they figure out that this study was not as good as they seem to think it was, that it was biased, there are different opinions, but it is harder to try to have an actual conversation where we are kind of hedging or couching all of our statements in the proper context. I think it's like what we run into with our on Ecology for the Masses when we do these paper breakdowns. Scientific papers are written in a very different format than what you read in the newspaper, for example.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of statements about saying like, well, we assume this, but we can't control for this, but this is what we did and this is what we think happens, but it could have been A, B, or C. But you can't really have a conversation like that with the non-scientific public very well and keep their interest. So it's a bit of balancing what your statements.
Right, and not to say that we're taking a statement of like, oh, the non-scientific public isn't going to be kept interested in this, but I do agree with Sam. It's easy to break trust, to lose trust, and to feed into what seems to be this growing idea of, oh, you know, science doesn't really know what it's doing, and a new paper will come out and debunk this in a week anyway, and there's no guarantees about any of this. This really only works if everybody's on the same page.
Yeah.
And
but getting everyone on the same page is a struggle. Like, I mean, because then what you're creating is essentially a political party bringing everyone under one banner, and we shouldn't be operating like that. But
No, but that's the only way you get agreement. I mean, I've been really impressed with this whole... We just had another paper come out basically saying, again, loud and clear, that the vaccines do not cause autism. And in fact, people that are not vaccinated are actually at a greater risk for autistic development, according to this new paper, which I still think
is interesting.
Not, right, but that also might just be... I mean, it was within the realm of standard deviation. It was like 7% deviancy within
it's
the
data. It's purely correlative.
Yeah. But I was reading like a little summary from one of the researchers, and they were saying, you know, do you really think that we need another paper that comes out that says, no, you know, we don't need, or autism and
apparently we do
not linked. And yeah. That's exactly what the researcher's belief was. It was, yeah, apparently we do. Apparently we need to keep producing these and keep reminding people. And so I don't think it's wrong for researchers to keep saying the exact same thing. I mean, we need more climate papers, apparently. We need to keep telling people over and over again that climate change is a real thing.
I think an important thing that we really do need for scientific communication is an effective communication of the actual proportions of the community that believes one side, or at least trusts in the evidence of one side or the other. Because at least in the U.S. with mainstream media, they tend to do a 50-50 split of like, well, here's the person for climate change, here's the person against. It's like, no. If it was real, it'd be like what John Oliver did, where you have 99 scientists yelling down the one scientist who's like, no, it's probably not real.
Yeah.
Not usually a scientist.
But you've got to remember that even within that debate itself, there's a lot of arguments on like what the changes are going to be like. The overwhelming consensus is that A, it's being generated by us, and B, it's negative. But aside from those two, there's very varying like opinions on what'll happen. And I mean, I say opinions because a lot of people think that scientists operate in fact, but personal bias gets in the way of anything. Even as something that should be as theoretically subjective as science, yeah.
Yep.
Anyway, we've nerded out here a bit, so let's get...
Humans are causing climate change, no question.
Wait. Before we begin, in the interest of mathematical balance, I'm going to bring out two people who agree with you, climate skeptic, and Bill Nye, I'm also going to bring out 96 other scientists.
Let's get back on track. My bad for getting us off that. So today we're looking at the bastard son of Loki and his ecology. So what I thought I'd do for our little history of in the cinema section is just go through a little bit of the representation of Norse gods in cinema.
Okay.
We'll obviously, you know, dip into Marvel's representation of them a little bit, but we'll try to stay away from that in general.
Hella.
But Marvel, when I thought of this, that wasn't actually the first one that came to mind. The first one that came to mind was The Mask.
Really?
Loki.
Yeah, Loki, son of Thor. Son of Odin. Yeah, so obviously The Mask is, you know, a trickster god prop or something. I have not seen that movie in a long time.
Nope.
But it's kind of a real... Because you always forget, you don't associate Jim Carrey's The Mask with Norse mythology.
Well,
in any way, shape, or form.
I mean, you associate Jim Carrey with crazy these days, but no, not so much.
You certainly do, yeah. We had a bit of a discussion about anti-vaxxers earlier. Hang on. Yeah, I'm pretty sure he was on board with that movement.
He was, because he was dating Jenny McCarthy. The thing is, The Mask movie has aged very well. Jim Carrey has not.
Oh, okay. I thought Jennifer Tilly was the one he was dating.
There's more anti-vaxxers.
Anyway, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
But yeah, The Mask, Son of the Mask are pretty good examples. There are so many films based on Beowulf. My God. There's the creepy, weird, Uncanny Valley CGI
2007 or whatever it was. With Angelina Jolie as Beowulf's mother.
Yeah, very, very strange. That didn't do too well at the time, I don't think. But there's a bunch of others. There's a Christopher Lambert version before that, I think in 1999.
But also, that's not Viking or Scandinavian. That's English, isn't it?
Beowulf?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know, but I'm pretty sure Beowulf is a
it's Anglo-Saxon, I thought.
The Anglo-Saxon
most of the Scandinavian folklore was lost, and that was the Elder Edda and the Younger Edda.
Beowulf is old.
Yeah, it's
English.
An old epic. Okay, fair enough. The story is set in Scandinavia.
It relates if it's set in Scandinavia.
There's a 1986 animated flick, mainly, you know, watched by Scandinavian children called Valhalla. And then, of course, recently we've had fantastic representation of Norse mythology in American Gods.
So
yeah.
No, I think the TV show is doing a pretty good job. But I tell you what, if you haven't read the book, give it a go. I actually think Neil Gaiman works better as a writer of comics. I think he takes a little too much time describing things that aren't that important, a la
America,
Tolkien, with to be fair. But it's a really good book. It's a great story, and Odin obviously plays a huge central role in it.
Mm-hmm. Yup.
Thor is briefly mentioned once as mm-hmm. having shot mm-hmm. himself in a diner in like the 60s or something like that. It's a very... American Gods is a very different take on Norse mythology and mythology in general.
Yeah.
Neil really Gaiman has actually since written a book on Norse mythology, just, you know, with some of the myths and that sort of stuff.
Norse gods, right?
Yeah. Norse gods, yeah. And Loki obviously also plays a huge role in that film as well. Should we give spoilers here, or?
I think so.
Yeah.
Dave, have you read the book?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, skip ahead if you don't want American Gods spoiled for you. But Mr. World, it turns out, is Loki, scheming behind the scenes the entire time, and Odin is very much the bad guy, as he is in a lot of mythology.
Yeah.
In a lot of ancient mythology, the gods were real.
Especially Greek mythology. They are the worst.
Oh, man.
Hey, this is not always the worst. They're human.
Yes, they are.
There's this fabulous pie chart of, problems in Greek mythology and the causes. It's like, the mortals are bad. Somebody had a fight with a duck, and then, 80% of it is just Zeus couldn't keep it in his pants.
Yep. Yeah. 90% of it.
Yeah. And then, of course, back in the 60s is when Thor first appeared in Marvel Comics.
Okay.
Now, it's a very kind of grey area. I think the modern comics interpret him as the Asgardians are just an alien race who are worshipped by early humans as deities, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they've changed the mythology quite severely. So as we mentioned last week, in particularly Thor Ragnarok, you see Hel and Fenris. Yeah.
Fenris.
Two creatures who, along with the Midgard Serpent, which I didn't know, traditionally half children of Loki's. Bastard children or something along those lines. And obviously in the Marvel comics they've been turned into villains, and I do not believe that even in the 60s they were portrayed as the offspring of said gods.
They were not.
Again,
the origin
Odin
of
very much portrayed
one of those, another
villains.
Bastard child of Loki's is like this eight-legged horse that somebody rides, and the story behind how that one came about is wonderful, because Loki, being the trickster, disguised himself as a horse, and another horse was like, hachi-machi, look at that horse, and then fucked him. And then Loki was pregnant and gave birth to a horse. Yep.
Loki does that a lot.
Yeah. Jesus
There's
Christ.
It's
like Bugs Bunny dressed up as a woman. Imagine thinking a guy was a woman. Imagine.
Sam mm-hmm. just finished watching Thor Ragnarok, so he will remember that when Thor is describing, there was this one time that Loki turned himself into a snake, because I love snakes.
Oh man, that's a good film.
Ah, stabby.
But yeah, they really get the whole Odin being kind of a dick down right in those films.
Yep.
There was more I wanted to say about the Thor's hammer in Norse mythology is a lot smaller. Like, it is nowhere near that big. Yeah. And he's kind of, it's much more quaint, I guess. There's none of this big
muscle.
He's dumb.
He's really dumb.
Yes, he is quite dumb, yeah.
And violent.
Actually, if you've ever read Sandman by Neil Gaiman, that has a fantastic representation of Thor in it.
Yes,
yeah.
It does.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, a very overly muscular man with a head the size of a pea and a hammer the size of the sort of thing you'd probably keep in your dad's toolbox.
And laughs and drinks a lot. He's a good mm-hmm. character.
Hits some women as well, but oh, the representation of Loki in that is fantastic too. So, yeah, I think that's most of what I wanted to talk about. I can't really think of any other representations of Norse mythology in the in film. Any classic representations?
The show Vikings, the one that History Channel did, they kind of touch on the gods a lot, but it's not so much the actual gods they're not manifesting in the show itself.
No.
I don't believe in the gods' existence.
Man is the master of his own fate, not the gods. The gods are man's creation to give answers that they are too afraid to give themselves.
Let's start off with the debate about food, because Adam and I are a little split on this.
Okay.
Okay.
So we have a creature that that has evolved somewhat, is obviously more aggressive, will kill moose, will kill humans. Yep. I'm of the opinion that it's still a herbivore. I don't think it's eating meat. I think it's just insanely territorial. So, yep. For instance, often hippos will slaughter just anything, deer, whatever, yes. that get into their yes. grounds. So I don't think it's eating the humans. I just think it's like crazy territorial.
Yeah, I mean, we don't see any kind of dentition on this creature at all, so it's hard to say what it would be. But from the way that it seems to have, I mean, it fits. It could easily go either way. Because as far as, if we're going to touch on briefly its territorial or its behavioral ecology, this is obviously a very, very territorial creature. And this is something that not only has strung up a ton of humans in the forest, you can see all their mummified husks all around the trees, but it's also doing this to other large animals. Like at the very beginning of the movie, we see that it's elk that has been strung up, and it's been, as the characters point out, strung up very recently because it is still bleeding and it looks warm. But for it to be doing this kind of thing, it has to have some kind of... It has to be patrolling the forest constantly. We kind of touched on that. Yeah, okay. Well, we can touch on this with the foraging the food. But basically, there's three or four main kind of topics we want to touch on this. One of them being its habitat and the distribution. Next one being its foraging and food. Excuse me. Then being the behavioral ecology, and lastly, kind of once again, the sexual selection as far as why it has these rather exaggerated traits. Yeah. But as far as foraging and food goes, its body plan and its habitat kind of go hand in hand to kind of lean towards a herbivore type lifestyle, where it is grazing on the trees, possibly smaller ground plants, but its massive size. These extra limbs on its face that it can then use to manipulate branches even more, much like an elephant's trunk. And its ability to stand on those hind legs means it can reach very, very high into the canopy. And as Sam pointed out in our little discussion, on our raw discussion, in the winter, you have these trees that have lost most of their vegetation except for higher up. And at least for the forest god, it's going to be able to reach those. So that makes sense as far as herbivory.
Not so much the winter, because most of the trees up there, I mean, you have conifers as well that they can take advantage of. But it's more just like year-round. They get access to so much more food this way.
Yes.
And I mean, we saw that with a lot of ancient megafauna. So if you've ever seen a chalicothea, spelled C-H-A-L-I-C-O-T-H-E-R-E.
I think it's chalicotheres.
Yeah. They evolved to... They were basically... I mean, they're ancestors of modern-day horses. They initially evolved two adaptations. Some had necks like giraffes that could allow them to get way higher up. Others were able to kind of stand up on two legs, as this thing does at times. I think a lot of the adaptations this has is to be able to increase the amount of food it can get, so it can constantly browse. Because you will come through like heavily populated parts of Norway in particular, because they don't have that many predators. But areas where like there's a very defined line, whereby below that line, maybe I don't know, 3 meters up, 2.5 meters up in the air, you have below that line no vegetation whatsoever. It's all being ripped off by moose. Above that, tons of vegetation. So as a herbivore, if you can increase that like elevational range at which you can get food, that's a huge bonus.
Absolutely. It's a ton of extra food.
Yeah.
And I think it does make more sense for this to be...
It's going to be important, considering for this creature to be this big, it's going to have to be consuming upwards of 50 to 60 pounds worth of vegetation per day.
Yeah.
Yeah. So 50, 60 pounds is...
About 20 kilos, 25 kilos.
Yeah, okay. I mean,
that's a lot of vegetation. So yeah, having that extra group to meet those metabolic demands, it's going to be really important.
Yeah.
And it's going to have some very high metabolic demands, because we can see in the movie, it can move quite quickly.
It's booking it.
And it's strong. And in the book, it's even more apparent how fast this thing is, moving from one side of the group of like a clearing to the other in a matter of seconds without them even realizing it. It's very fast. It's very quiet. But, as much as I enjoy the idea of a large carnivorous ungulate, I think it makes more sense for this to be herbivorous completely. and the territoriality aspect makes sense as far as how it's killing everything that comes into its territory.
And again, we can't speak to the fact of, depending on how old it is or if it has suffered through some previous trauma, neurologically, we can't speak to how intact it might be in terms of, like, if it's just running around fucking everything up, there could be something neurologically inappropriate about this creature.
It also could just be, you know, I mean, this is the thing, the attacking things, if they're in rut, or if it's a mother protecting kids, which it's not because it's the wrong time of year.
Unless there are children that we don't see in the area, or it's created some sort of inappropriate bond with the humans in some way that we see some animals do. That lose children and then start to consider another animal or another species to be basically their offspring.
Yeah.
It's not unreasonable to believe this creature might have created some sort of false assessment of what these humans or what those strange creatures in the attic mean to it.
I mean, maybe it gets food from them, or I don't know.
But I'll touch on that when we get to its behavioral ecology, because I think there's definitely something to that.
Okay.
But kind the of aggression...
Go ahead, Sam.
The aggression, killing things, that makes sense, I guess, if they're territorial and they're being threatened. What doesn't make sense is stringing up the corpses, because that attracts, like, other predators. Like, that's gonna bring in wolves, bears, all that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's a good point. It doesn't really make sense to put up something that is gonna smell, and especially because you're not eating it, you're not consuming it. And other animal is going to see it as a warning sign.
No, they're not. But this could be a case of this animal being somewhat intelligent, which I think it has to be for many of its behaviors, and it could be using these as a lure of a sense to then bring these macro predators where it wants them to be, so it can then take them out one by one, as opposed to stumbling across them.
Basically,
it's a stretch. It's a big stretch.
It's not a great system.
No, it's not.
But this is the thing. I don't think. That any predator is going to fuck with this thing. Because there's already few enough predators that would fuck with a fully grown adult moose, like a bull moose.
This is bigger.
This is way bigger.
And way more aggressive.
Yeah, so I don't think this thing is going to have too much problem with predators at all.
I think this might be a case of maybe not bringing in predators, but if we're assuming that there used to be a lot more of these things in this habitat, that this is maybe a... just how they mark their territory. They could lack scent glands, or they might not be able to musk trees like other large animals do. And so instead, they string up corpses. If a new one comes into its territory, it can see how big the territory is, see that there's already something else here.
Okay.
And it would maybe either be deterred or know that it's in the right track to challenge somebody for its territory.
The last explanation could be a false lure, in the idea of we see lots of species that either attempt to move away from the nest or create things away from the nest that draw predators to those and keep them away from the young. If this creature does have some sort of false sense of what it believes, or there are young in the area that we just don't see, it could be putting up dead animals in various areas to basically make the predators go there and keep them away from whatever it's trying to protect.
Yeah, because I did say that I don't think anything like is going to be big enough to fuck with it, but if it's got kids, then it's still going to be protecting the kids. You know?
Right.
And anything when it's a baby is vulnerable.
Right. You're right, exactly. The wolf isn't going to fuck with the fully grown moose, but it's definitely going to fuck with the offspring.
Exactly, yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
Now, should we talk about, like, habitat distribution?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's going to be eating we're thinking it's going to be feeding off these trees, be able to get very high into them, so it's going to be kind of locked to this very old-growth forest that has these massive old-growth trees. And at least, we see at the end of the movie, it does not leave the forest, which I think in the movie it's kind of meant to be a supernatural kind of locked to the forest itself. But... I think as far as this goes, it is maybe it's been injured and it's hesitant to leave its territory because it would then be even more threatened.
Yeah. I think it's just kind of, it's angry at this point, but I think it's also scared. Like, I don't think, there's anything like I don't think any creature would normally be that, like, worried about dispersal. Like, I cannot go on this certain point. Like, moose don't need to worry about that. I mean, especially, like, aggressive males. Yeah.
One thing that people assume about, like, birds, for example, is because they can fly, they can go anywhere, but that's not necessarily true. You have...
No.
Right.
They treat certain habitats as incredibly dangerous for, like, flying across a clearing, for example, because now you're exposed to every single predator in that area.
Yeah. But moose, for instance, like, especially, like, males, they'll expose themselves. They'll leave forest. I mean, they don't tend to do it as much, especially
it's perverted,
if
it's
predators
sick.
In the area. Yeah. This thing, I don't think this thing would have any problem with exposing itself whatsoever.
This thing probably has two dicks, let's be honest. And a vagina.
Jesus.
But we do run into the same sort of issue that we've had with the trolls before, whereby, why aren't there more of them if it just needs forest? But as we've said, like, we think old growth forests must hold them. Now, while Europe has so much forest, a lot of Europe, I mean, that's artificially kind of planted, that's new growth forest, cultured forest. Europe has destroyed most of its original, like, old growth forest back in the day, and old growth...
There's hardly any left.
Yes, there's almost none of it left. So the old growth forest has much higher levels of biodiversity and ecosystem functioning than new growth forest. So that might have something to do with why their range is so restricted.
Yeah.
Having said that, the part of Sweden this is in, I don't think that's old growth forest.
Okay.
Because you get a brief look on the map. I think it's probably... I'm not 100% sure, but I don't think it is.
In the book, they make a very big point of how it is a very isolated, very old growth forest that is very ancient.
Okay, so supposed to be. Yeah, so maybe its range has just been cut down by fragmentation.
Yeah.
It's probably had some bad experiences with humans, this sort of species in the past, and it's now, you know, been whittled down. Because if you had that living in your fucking backyard, you would hunt the shit out of it.
Absolutely you would. Because that thing would kick you out of the forest.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you don't want something hanging around that could kill your kids. Like, Norwegian Scandinavians, they're paranoid as fuck about, like, bears, wolves, wolverines. They kill those things straight away. Yeah. Well, the Swedes are slightly better with it than the Norwegians.
Or maybe they've had some success. Maybe that's why we're only seeing one.
Exactly. That's what I'm thinking. Like,
And why its habitat is so fragmented, it can no longer disperse to where there are other members of the species left.
Right, Yeah, we don't know if there are any left, and we've had this discussion before about species that are either basically on the brink of extinction or... Sam, you had a great term, Adam, you guys, for when an animal extinction is basically... species what?
I said extinction debt,
I'm pretty sure this is something, a term that my advisor or his PhD advisor coined, and it's called the ecological walking dead. It's a species that is still extant, but it is so, its habitat is so limited, its gene pool is so restricted, its opportunities for mating are so restricted, it is well on its way out. It's doomed.
Right. Yeah. Beyond the point of no return. Yeah. However, this is not to say that you might have like a really isolated population in Russia or in the boreal forest somewhere in a very unpopulated part of it.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's just like we touched on with the trolls. This habitat is the largest habitat on the planet. There's so many places this thing could be. So for all we know, they are in Russia.
Right, and I don't know if we've stuck this in already, but like just again as a standard disclosure statement before we start, we are completely ruling out the fact that this creature has been a child of Loki and is one of a kind, and we are treating this like it's an actual species that has evolved on the planet and is being worshipped by a group of people that think that it's a god. Because if we just say child of Loki, we can get away with anything.
Yeah, so moving on from its habitat and its food to kind of its behavior, we touched on the territoriality briefly, but for the way this works, at least in nature, territory animals are going to be they're going to behave much, much differently than those that are non-territorial. They have to expend a lot of energy to maintain territory and to defend it. They also, at least for the animals that I work with, they spend a lot of energy defending females as well. With its kind of its size and its long gait and its need to move around constantly to find enough food, it makes sense to kind of go hand in hand to kind of kill two birds with one stone or put two humans in one tree, where you have to patrol the forest, you kind of maintain your territory, and you get to forage for a lot of food. And it also means you can stick up plenty of corpses all around the territory and keep things kind of maintained. And we're assuming that this is a male, so these trophies could represent not only its territorial borders and a indication of its status of a high-quality male to other males, but it could also indicate its status to females who would then come into its territory looking to mate.
Yep. Yeah, for sure.
And with its intelligence, I think this creature is a semi-domesticated in that it has lived around humans, at least in these isolated humans, enough that it has learned that they can represent both a threat or a resource in that... The book makes more of a description of how this thing has been systematically worshipped for generations. They find a church in the book where there is an altar for it. There is a structure that's meant, obviously, as somewhat of a sacrificial altar or an execution post where they will bring some kind of person or a deer or something lay it out, and the creature will then stomp its head in, because they find plenty of crushed skulls. So
it's like having a bird bath in your backyard.
Exactly. Yeah, you know, sacrificial altar, bird bath, same thing.
You have crushed skulls in your bird bath, Sam?
Well,
you're
I
doing
don't have
it
a bird bath. I live in an apartment. I would hang crushed skulls out the window if I was allowed to, but the Norwegian government is really tired
Silly
on that.
Silly government.
I know, right?
Sam really wanted a balcony attached to his apartment, but he wasn't
I
able to
did.
Get one.
I really did, actually. That's not it. You're not lying there. I really did, yeah.
Yeah. And I think that going back to its kind of semi-domestication, it has become so accustomed to humans and so dependent on their either the added food they can bring to it, maybe they're planting some vegetables for it, or it just takes advantage of any kind of garden that they have, that's why you see it trying to make Luke worship it. It knows that he might be the last opportunity that it has for this continued somewhat symbiotic relationship with humans, and it's trying to get him to acquiesce to it or to submit to it.
It might even just be, like, playing with him at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just, I mean, you know, you've seen dogs knock people over when they're just trying to get a hug.
I mean, I don't think this thing is trying to get a hug.
No, you know,
you never
just,
know.
Maybe it just wants pets, man. It just wants pets.
Even horrible monsters want a little boop on the snoot.
Exactly, every now and then.
We don't know where its snoot is, sure. But
I mean,
it
did get a boop on the snoot with a big fucking hatchet, but, you know, it's probably not quite what it was looking for, yeah.
Exactly.
But, yeah, there was another aspect of the behavior I wanted to touch on in relation to the humans. Yeah, Dave mentioned last week that, I mean, it just puts a human down right next to the axe. I mean, yeah, it might have just ceased to see humans as a threat. Animals do become more naive when they're removed from predators,
right,
when they're removed from areas with humans, so... It may just not see him as a threat at that point. And yeah, it might just be, you know, toying around with him and not expect the axe to the face.
No, definitely did not expect that.
Might not have seen it, even.
Yeah. Now, again, we've said this before, even if it can run as fast as a moose, which, like we said before, it can book it. Like, it can get up to 35 miles an hour, which is probably what a moose can generally do.
50K
in open
or so.
Country, I should say. Again, I don't think this would be a large threat to humans.
No.
I mean, yeah.
You're going to see this thing coming through the forest. I mean, despite that it attempts...
You're
going to
hear
it
coming.
Yeah. It seems to camouflage itself pretty well. It's fucking big. I mean, besides having a couple of really well-shot horror angles where it's positioned itself perfectly in the tree with the humans, and any realistic situation, if the humans were in a slightly different angle or the position, they'd just see this huge animal kind of sitting with this tiny little tree in front of it, being like, oh, you can't see me.
No, to be fair, okay, so I am a clumsy motherfucker. However, I spent, I've probably mentioned this before, I spent 2 weeks on Vega, which is an island off the coast of Norway, back in 2016, stalking moose for, you know, data, just trying to get a read on them, a bit of info about the calves, that sort of thing. They are not as easy to find as you would think.
No, but...
They move very quietly. They are, if you're like lying at ground level and you can't see the body and there's just like thick brush and trees, their legs are almost indistinguishable from tree trunks.
You also see this in even animals that are a little bit smaller, things like deer or even their mountain lion predators, that when they're not moving or when they're in their natural environment, you might think that like their camouflage isn't that superior, but when you're actually looking for it in nature, you cannot find it until it moves.
Yeah. And there's, like Adam said, there's a couple of great examples of that in this film. Like, there's one, that one
touched
scene
on it last
where,
week, yeah.
Yeah, there's that one scene, which is horrifying, where they're just, like, stumbling up a hill, and then all of a sudden something moves in the background. You didn't even realize it was there, you just see
it
move.
It was maybe 10, 20 meters from them, if that.
Yeah, yeah, it's a great scene. And that is what, I mean, I had that exact experience with a moose once, like... My supervisor was just... Endre, who was on the show a couple of...
Oh, yeah,
2-3 weeks ago.
Yeah.
He was pointing. He was like, it's right fucking there. What is wrong with you? And I'm like, I can't see it. And then it moves. It's like, oh, yeah, it's right there. Yeah.
I had a similar thing happen when Pokemon Go first came out. I was so excited to be back in the U.S. and actually have a phone with data. I was walking through the park. I was walking my dog. I was on the phone just catching Pokemon the entire way. And then I heard a noise, I looked up, and I was literally in the middle of a herd of fucking deer. They were on both sides of the path, there were at least 30 of them, and I had not seen them until I heard a sound. They were so close to me I could touch them, it was insane.
Yeah. Endre, another story Endre has about moose that he didn't tell you about last time, is which he should have, because it's a great story. He was tracking this moose, and he had like the beeper with him, so it, you know, beeps more often when you're getting closer to it. And he couldn't figure out where the hell it was, and then like 10 meters in front of him, it just stood up. It was the time of the year where they've just grown their antlers, and the velvet is shedding. So it's just this male moose has stood up, and it is dripping blood from its antlers, and just looks him dead in the eyes, and then walks off after a bit. But I mean, that thing could have charged,
and would have killed him.
Would have murdered that motherfucker right in the face. Yeah. Anyway, back on track. What are we going to talk about now?
A bit, kind of a mixing of the sexual selection and the territorial ecology. Dave was having trouble with its, what looks like, hyperkeratinized skin. It looks like it's been burned. Yeah. And we're touching on how that kind of adaptation you really only see in nature when it's a response to some very a superior predator. And we don't think this thing is going to be vulnerable to any kind of predator in that environment, even other environments possibly. It's a massive, well-defended, enormous creature. It's strong, it's fast, it's going to be hard to take this thing down. But I'm thinking that, at least as far as males go, in cervids and like elk, I don't know if moose do it, but in deer, you have a lot of these battles for dominance between males, where they will lock horns, they will try to kill each other, they will try to either make them submit or just straight up kill them in order to take territory, to take a harem of females, what have you. And I'm thinking that this could be an adaptation, that these creatures are so big and their rack of antlers is enormous and sharp and it's pointed forward, even though it moved the antlers at the end of the movie, but that's a whole separate thing. That this hybrid keratinized skin could be either a defense that is kind of evolved, but Dave's shaking his head, and I kind of think that it's more of a kind of a symptom of past battles where it's scar tissue, it's been wounded before.
But it's just, it's so generalized from head to toe. Like, it's just, like, it's everywhere. It's not like it's a couple of areas of scarring, unless, like, there's creatures coming up and starting at one end of it with its horns and dragging it all the way down. Like, all of it is covered in this hyperkeratinized, oddly shaped, blackish, like, just, it doesn't look healthy. And I know that's part of the horror theme to try and make it look like it. But it just looks fucked.
Yeah.
It could also be this creature is these fights, so big.
Because you know how it's got like the arm. You know how it's got like the miniature arms on its face as well.
Yeah.
All I can think of is like the moose like locking horns with each other, and then the little arms just slapping each other in the face.
You couldn't though. In the eyes. Exactly. You'd have to reach into that scary ass alcove though to try and slap it in the face, and I've got no idea what's waiting in that thing.
I would not
put my hand in there, yeah.
Like, we were talking about this earlier, of like, oh, like, you could punch it in the face. No, like, you don't want to nose boop that thing, because I'm not sticking my arm into that face vagina.
You're going to lose that arm.
Yeah. Some sort of weird arm-based
system. It makes me think you can go noodling for motors. If you two know what noodling is.
No, I don't know what noodling is.
So down here in the South, what people like to do for fun when they go looking for catfish is you find like a little hollow under a bank, and you just stick your arm in there, and you see what latches on, you pull out a fish.
Right.
Oh, God, I would not have the courage to do that.
Absolutely not. I've seen snapping turtles. I know how big they are. I don't want to lose my fingers.
Oh, God. I've told that story about snapping turtles on here before. I won't do it again.
I don't know if you have. But
No, I did once, but then I cut it out later in the episode.
Okay. Anyway, so. Going back to the... to its hyperkeratinized skin. It could also be an adaptation to the environment it lives in. At least we are thinking that it would be native to a very old growth, very dense forest, which is not very conducive to an animal of this size. And so having a bit of thicker skin would be advantageous when it's brushing against all these somewhat sharp branches constantly.
Yeah, true, but I feel like you'd see it on a lot of the stuff. I agree with what you're saying, but I feel like you would see it on moose. Moose do have fairly thick hides.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But... I don't think you would need that sort of weird skin.
I think it would need fur. And I think that that's the other problem, is that the hair is growing in patches that make absolutely no sense.
I think it's just old and it's all falling out.
Yeah, I mean, it could just be ancient and falling apart. But again, it's a very strange presentation. And the skin just, it doesn't, like, if it's an elephant or if it's designed, then the skin tends to be an even sheet because all the skin has developed from the same type of cell.
Yeah.
If you look at some of the pictures that I put up or some of like the artist designs, the skin is unevenly thick and distributed, and there are veins that are present. And again, that spine coming out through that area, it just all looks like previous trauma.
Yeah.
And No, but I think it would be quite an old specimen. Like, just based on moose and reindeer antlers and what they look like, and based on what this has for antlers. Look, it is old. They're well-developed antlers. Antlers come back larger every year and generally more elaborate. They're actually the fastest-growing organ on the face of the planet. It's an organ. There's blood vessels running through them.
Yeah.
over a long period of time, I mean.
God damn it.
Presumably this thing loses its antlers. That would make sense. Although the female reindeer keep their antlers all year round. But anyway, the point is that this thing is quite old, but not that old. I'd say maybe 15, 16 years. And moose can live up to 25 years. 1920 is...
I mean, we don't have any good way of aging this thing, because it might have a limit that basically the horns grow to and stop, which we do see in some species. And again, I don't have any access to dentition or other facial features or anything, or any frame of reference. I do agree it has to be an adult. I hope it's a fucking adult. It has to be an adult based on, like, everything else. But the range could be anything from, you know, 6 to 60 years, depending on how long this thing is, what its design is supposed to be. I mean, I imagine it's going to have a lifespan similar to a moose, but we've got no evidence to support that.
Yeah. But at least from its body plan and the way the antlers look, we're assuming that these are antlers, and like Sam was saying, they do shed and grow back bigger every year, more elaborate, so we can kind of age this like we would a moose. It's probably close to 20 years, maybe, and it's probably on the latter end of its life.
Yeah, I just don't know what size the antlers start at, and we do know that certain species go through points of limitation of, like, your growth only goes so far. In the same way as, like, eyebrow hair does thicken as we mature and become adults, but it doesn't continue to go until, like, your entire face is covered.
Yeah.
And, like, it only grows out so far. That's why some people, if you pluck their eyebrows, the hair never grows back. 5% of the population will not grow their eyebrow hair back. So think about that the next time you think it's funny to shave a friend's eyebrows.
Is that all?
I mean, we can briefly touch on the sexual selection because we're kind of getting close on time. But it's basically just these enormous antlers only make sense in an organism that is being sexually selected for, where it's kind of a decoupling from its natural selection for the environment and survival. In a selection on what the females like, and at least with these kind of organisms, the bigger the antler, the better it can defend itself, the better it can fight a male, the sexier it looks to the females.
And I think that's the big thing, is going to be fighting other males, because the way that these are positioned and the type of antler, I mean, there's a reason why moose have big swinging large round antlers that they can get closer to the ground to strike something. These antlers would not work for the purposes of trying to attack, and you don't see this animal use the antlers for the purposes of trying to attack or hurt anything within the film.
Also, if you like being attacked by a wolf, it is a high, it's got a really high up head, like swooping those antlers down to take on, like,
it doesn't it wouldn't be predators. Able to. If it swoops them down, it would put its face, vagina, and arms into the dirt if it tried to do that.
No, it makes no sense whatsoever. Also, the amount of exertion it would take to, like,
it's just dumb.
Think that, though, we can kind of maybe touch on this briefly as, like, a really cool, very farcical adaptation, where in the end we do see it manipulate the antlers and swing them forward, so they are kind of more wide set, like a traditional serpent antlers are, because that makes sense, at least from a territorial or a fighting aspect or defense, to have them like that. But then the ability to then bring them back and keep them behind your head would also be incredibly advantageous in a forest like this.
Sure.
There was one time when we were children, he transformed himself into a snake, and he knows that I love snakes. So I went to pick up the snake to admire it, and he transformed back into himself, and he was like, "Yeah, it's me!" And he stabbed me.
So, for our verses this week, I'm going to kind of sit this one out. We've had our little debate about whether or not Beowulf is or isn't Norse mythology, but we've decided firmly to plant him into Norse mythology for this verses. And pit Beowulf up against the Forest King / Modor / Bastard Child of Loki. Guys, I know nothing about Beowulf, as evidenced earlier in this podcast. What do we reckon?
So I will set the scene, we'll let Dave kind of defend this, but in Beowulf, the reason that Beowulf kind of grows to stature is he's a famous warrior, but the reason he's able to kill the monster that's haunting his meat hall is what happens is every night, everyone's sleeping in the meat hall, Grendel, the monster, will come in, eat somebody, and take off. And so what Beowulf does is pretend to be asleep, wait for Grendel to come, and then he gets in a wrestling match and he rips Grendel's arm off. So Beowulf's strategy, I think, would have to be sleeping in the woods and waiting for this team to come to try to put him in a tree. Dave, how does this go?
And Adam is also leaving out the point that seems to vary from scholar to scholar, but was a factor in a number of the Beowulf movies of he was sleeping naked at the time to try and prepare for Grendel's attack.
So, how else do you sleep?
Right, yeah, exactly. So he's preparing. He's been sent out by the local chief to try and wipe this thing out. And I agree with Adam. I think this makes the most sense that he's fallen asleep. He wants to prove that he is a warrior of renown that's going to be able to fight off this creature.
The baddest of all badasses.
Yeah. He's fucked. Beowulf was incredibly strong. He was a very, very powerful creature. I also see the big problem Beowulf runs into here is he doesn't know which arm to try and rip off. Because he could very easily jump up, rip off one of the arms from the hip and be like, ha ha, what are you going to do now? And then this thing could just stomp him into the ground. His normal strategy
that's of ripping... It's his one move. That's all he knows. He just grabs an arm, he rips it off.
Yeah. His one strategy here, his general game plan, or he's going to run into that classic scenario where he gets up and he just sees all of these limbs and he freezes because he's not sure which one to reach for first, giving the creature a long enough
chance.
And it
stomps his head in.
Yeah, to just knock him in, and then it's one of those awkward scenes where you're walking along and you find Beowulf strung up in the tree and you're just like, ooh, that didn't work out the way he thought it was going to.
With his guts like hanging Sean out.
Yeah. The what?
Does he look like Sean Bean?
Yeah. We'll say that he looks like Sean Bean, yes.
All right, I like...
With a weird CGI face? Okay, that's good, yeah.
Yeah, a Beowulf that looks like Sean Bean, I can live with that. Yeah.
Cool. It also doesn't help that Grendel the monster is very, very dumb, and we think into the forest god is fairly intelligent, so Beowulf's fucked.
And this also helps us because my favorite Beowulf interpretation has Anthony Hopkins playing the chieftain leader, who plays, of course, Odin in the Marvel movies, so I can kind of link this back, which I enjoy. So I'm imagining.
And Angelina Jolie, who was Beowulf's mother, and she also played Maleficent, so maybe she's Mordor.
Yep. But no, Mordor would totally stomp Beowulf. It would end his proud career, unfortunately.
As a naked arm ripping off a warrior.
Yeah, he would end up facing Ragnarok at the end a little bit sooner than he was planning on.
Cool. Okay. All right, well, I think that's it for this week then. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. Like I said, if you enjoyed this and you haven't listened to last week's episode, go and check it out where we looked at the physiology of this creature. Next week, Dave and I will be going solo as Adam has his PhD candidacy exam. We'll be looking at some of the best and worst movie scientists out there, which is a fun thing that I've been looking forward to for a long time. I think we could go on about this for like 2 hours. There might be a part one and a part two to this.
There should be. There should be.
Yeah.
There could be a good example and a bad example episode.
Yeah, well, we might do just one this time and then a second one later on when Adam's more available.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, everybody, tweet at Adam to wish him luck for his PhD candidacy exam, which he'll be setting in 2 days, I believe, when this comes out. Adam, you want to take us home?
Absolutely. Tweet all your thoughts and prayers and your wishes for my poor self at Hasek Adam. You can tweet at Sam and tell him he's not a real candidate at Sam Perrin NTNU. Tweet the podcast at C_Animalia. Check out our website, cinematicaanimalia.com. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, or suggestions for future monsters, hit us up at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. We would love to hear about all these niche horror movies that we haven't heard about with all these monsters, especially they're foreign. Want to see some of the more hard science that Sam and I do on Ecology for the Masses, check out ecologyforthemasses.com. And remember, the monsters aren't real, but the science is.
Yeah. Bye, guys.
See you guys.